This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, along with retired top trainer and my usual entry mate here on the program. He is the pontiff of the Pick 4, Jude Feld, and we do welcome everybody joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220 XM Channel 206, and everyone tuning in worldwide with our live streaming on your computer, your mobile device, or whatever it may be, at horseracingradio.net. All kinds of ways to listen to the Horse Racing Radio Network, JT.
Yeah, and everybody's going to be using them because we're fast approaching the busiest time of the year.
Yeah, getting ready to kick off Kentucky Derby Week, and nobody knows that better than our special guest here tonight. He is trainer Clifford Sice Jr., and he has saddled 779 winners to date with more than $21 million in purse earnings. He saddled his first graded stakes winner, Paying Dues, in 1996. 20 years later, he's hoping to saddle his first Kentucky Derby starter with the talented Dancing Candy. And he's with us here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Clifford, welcome to the program, my friend.
No, thanks for having me.
How about those words, saddle a Kentucky Derby starter? Kind of has a nice ring to it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's got a good ring.
Hey, look, this show's airing 10 days prior to the Derby. How you holding up?
Me or the horse?
Well, let's start with you. How are you holding up?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm not even thinking about it yet. So. I'm perfect.
All right.
The horse is perfect, too.
Yeah, I was going to say, how's the horse? Dancing Candy, doing
very
okay?
Very good. Yeah, I brought him down to San Luis Rey after the Derby, and man, he's trained really good down here.
Well,
really, really good.
I've known you a long time, and that's one thing I always liked about you. You never got rattled, no matter what. You were always always the same in the mornings when we were together. You just go about your work. You never get too high and never get too low. That's a great quality for a trainer to have.
No, you can't. We're like yo-yos. We're up, we're down. Yeah. We're up, we're down.
Clifford, is it harder at this time of year leading up to maybe your first Kentucky Derby starter to kind of keep things in balance and keep an even keel?
Well, the horse helps, you know, because he does that on his own, you know. He's a very healthy horse. He's eating great. He likes his track down here. He worked awesome last Saturday. I mean, it's the horse himself. He's thriving right now. So he is doing good, very good. Right now, I think he's the best he's ever been right now.
Well, it's interesting that you made the decision to keep him on the West Coast, whereas many of the other Derby horses have already arrived at Churchill Downs. Talk about that strategy and what went into that planning.
Well, you know, I look at the weather report back there, and, you know, a lot of rain, and... you know, here we know the sun's going to be out. It's beautiful. And we know we're not going to hit a wet track to work on. So that was our main reason to stay here late, you know. And he ships good, you know. He's a good shipper. So just come in, stand him in the gate, take him to the paddock. That's it.
Is he going to breeze one more time before you bring him here?
Yeah, he works Saturday. Mm-hmm. Yes. Saturday here at San Luis Rey at 7:30.
Well, Clifford, I did a little bit of research for the program. I'm going to throw a statistic out there that might give you a little bit more confidence, as if you need any more, because this horse can really run. But he was fourth in the Santa Anita Derby last time out, after winning the San Felipe in his prior start. Now, 17 Kentucky Derby winners have prepped in the Santa Anita Derby. 9 of them have won both, of course. Of the other 8 who were beaten in the Santa Anita Derby but came back to win the Kentucky Derby, 3 of those 8 finished 4th in the Santa Anita Derby. So you're in good company. Yeah. You finished in the right position.
Oh, okay. That was a pretty fast half mile he ran that day, you know. At 45-1, I think. You know, and plus he didn't really, Mike said he didn't really like the slop. We thought he'd all love it, you know, because he's got such a nice way of moving. But Mike said every time he dropped his head, he just starts skating, you know. So, you know, I'm hoping we just draw a line through that race and get back to the way he was running before, you know.
Yeah, there's been a few horses that have had to deal with an off track and didn't really seem to relish it. Mo Heyman comes to mind with that as well, and he's come back to breeze well after the debacle in Florida. So,
right.
You know, a lot of people say, oh, you know, you shouldn't blame the track or whatever, but I think those people haven't trained horses. Talk about the fact that some horses just can't stand up in the mud.
Yeah, well, plus this. That 45-1 didn't help either. That's a little quick going a mile and eight, especially on the track he was on. You know, he got really gooey that race. You know, we had a little rain right before, so you know it wasn't like sloppy. It was a little like, you know, track was, you know, it was not like the race before or the race after. You know, it was really gooey. You know, but I got to give credit to Mr. DeSarmo, both brother and brothers, they did a great job on their horse. He loves the mud. That horse ran awesome.
Well, Clifford, you definitely don't want him throwing down 45-1 fractions on the first Saturday in May going a mile and a quarter either. So what have you done since the Santa Anita Derby to maybe get him to relax just a little bit more, or have you done anything?
No, I haven't really done anything. I mean, he is nice and relaxed down here, but, you know, I'll probably train him a little harder the day of the race and, you know, and the day before, you know. So he was a little too fresh going in that race too, you know. So I'll do a few things a little different, you know, try to keep him a little more on the quiet side, you know.
Have you allowed yourself to think about what it might be like to see Dancing Candy in front as they cross the wire beneath those twin spires?
And, you know, it'd be nice. Like I say, right now, I'm just day by day right now. You know, nothing, I'll get excited probably when we start walking over with the horse to the race.
Talking with trainer Clifford Seiss Jr. on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Cliff, you were in this position last year with Prospect Park. He was very, very talented. Ended up finishing 4th in the Santa Anita Derby. You said afterwards he just wasn't himself, came up with a bit of a high white blood cell count, a bit of a temperature. You had to take him out of Derby consideration. That had to be somewhat heartbreaking considering how close you were with such a talented horse.
Him, yeah. He's a lot tougher to train, keep him healthy. You know, he's a big, big horse. And if American Pharoah wasn't running, I'd feel sick about it, but you know, nobody was going to be an American Pharoah anyway, so it makes you feel a little better that, you know, that had to happen. You know, not that we wanted it to, but, you know, there, if you take American Pharoah out of the picture, then, you'd be very upset that you weren't able to go, you know.
Yeah, that certainly takes the pressure off, because I think you're right. He was certainly best on the day and proved later on how great he is. But it's always tough when you're on the cusp of a big race and something like that happens. It's, as you said before, like a yo-yo, up and down.
Yeah, right, you know.
Clifford, for people that have never trained horses, such as myself, for example, I know Jude has, and when something like that does happen, how difficult is it for a trainer to come to the barn the next morning, get started again, and say, all right, here we go, let's keep this thing rolling?
Well, we knew something was bugging him all week. We knew we were fighting a little something all week up to that Santa Anita Derby with Prospect Park, you know. So, and you know, the two times he's kind of a mucus carrier, and so the two times he's gotten that way was for the San Anita Derby and the Del Mar Derby. You know, his Del Mar Derby, he was fighting a little trouble too. You know, he's a lot tougher to train. You know, to keep super healthy. You know,
well,
where Danzig is just he just does his job and that's it.
Now let's hope he continues to do that for another 10 days for you as you make your way down to Churchill Downs and the Kentucky Derby. Clifford, let's start with your background and let's go back to the beginning. You have the privilege of now training pretty much in your backyard at Santa Anita as you were raised in Arcadia. Tell me about how you became involved with horse racing.
Oh, I was a little kid and we lived up in the Highlands in Arcadia, and Jimmy Jordan lived on our street, a couple other horsemen. And then, I just always loved horses because, you know, back those days, a lot of people had horses in their backyard and chicken coops and, you know, that's where Arcadia used to be. And then, when my mom became Jimmy Jordan's best friend, and then, he let me come out and walk hots during Christmas vacation, like 11 years old. And then we always kept a trailer down at the old Seaside Village. And so I got to know all the racetrackers there. And then I met up, you know, I was good friends with KL and Kevin Stuckey. So I learned how to gallop horses at Pomona and on the backside of Del Mar when I was like 12. And I just always loved it. You know, once you get blood, horse in your blood, you can't get it out. you can't, you know. Because I got off the track for like 8 years in the catering business, and I had to come back, you know.
Yeah, well, it's especially, I think, attractive when you live in the Los Angeles area because it's not that rural, and you very rarely got to see a horse unless you went to the track or, you know.
Right.
So it's a different kind of life.
Yeah, I feel like in Arcadia when I was a little kid, there used to be a, right there on Santa Anita Avenue, there used to be a riding, you know, where you would rent horses. And you could ride all the way up Santa Anita, up into the mountains back in those days. But I was little, so the first time I ever got on a shoveling pony was at a birthday party. I was maybe like 6 years old. He flipped with me.
Oh, oh no.
Yeah. So now my mom goes over to some lady's house, friend, and her daughter's got a buckskin pony. So I said, you know, can I ride it? She goes, sure. So I get on it. And you remember those old wired clothesline wires back in those days?
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, that thing took my neck off, you know. So, yeah, that was my first two riding horses. Fell off both.
Well, all right, so wait a minute. Now, you got banged up pretty good as a kid, Clifford, because I remember, you almost died when you were, what, 12 years old? Is that true?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I got ran over by a car. I was a hospital 6 weeks. Coma, 3 weeks. Yeah. Yeah.
So losing a horse race really doesn't, you put it all in perspective, right? It really doesn't mean all that much, right?
No, I mean, you know, we all want to win, but we lose more than we win. You know, even if you're a high percentage, 20%, that means you're winning 1 out of 5, but you have 4 horses that, you know, that didn't win, you know. It's a tough game, a very tough game.
How did you end up being run over by a car? How did that come about?
We lived up in the Highlands, like I said, and our street was very steep, and I was on a flexi, which is like a sled with wheels. So I looked down the street and no lights or anything. So I went down my buddy's driveway, and next thing I'm remembering, I try to, remember those big old heavy Rivieras back in, you know, those days, those things were tanks, you know. They sat low to the ground and everything. And I remember trying to jump over the hood because he didn't have his lights on. He was drunk and blind in one eye. So he didn't have his lights on, and that's the last thing I remember, trying to jump over the hood, but I didn't make it. So I was drug up like two houses underneath his car, and my parents were having a big dinner party that night, and, you know, it was a bad deal.
Wow.
But I ended up breaking, like, you know, my hip, my pelvis, pubis, sacrum, you know, all the bones in your, you know. And there's nothing you could do. All I could do is lay in bed for 6 weeks, you know. And then I was in, like, in a coma for 3 weeks, and then came out of that, you know. But I survived.
Wow, amazing. Just an amazing story. Clifford Seiss Jr. here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Clifford, was any of your family involved in horse racing or interested in any way?
My mom was, her and Sally Jordan used to go to the races. You know, she was a $2 better, $3, you know, $4, $6 better back in those days. But, yeah, I bought my dad's first horse for like $300, and, you know, he ended up winning a few races. So my dad was into, he kind of got into it then. You know, we bred and bought some babies and stuff like that. And my brother, he ended up, you know, training a little bit. And, no, I was the start of everything, you know. You know, I was the one that got into the game and got them into the game.
You kicked it off for the whole family. Well, it's you know, when exactly did you get your license, your first training license? You must have been pretty young.
Yeah, I was like 20, and that was kind of like unheard of in those days, you know. You know, in those days, if you weren't, you know, 45 or 55 gray hair, you didn't train horses, you know. So, yeah, at the time, I was the youngest person to ever get a trainer's license in California. 20 years old.
Wow. And that's not an easy place for a kid to break in to that profession either.
No, but, you know, I rode for like three, well, I rode a little bit. I rode for like 3.5 years, and, you know, I knew a lot of trainers, and, you know, and I was assistant trainer for Luke Glauberg back in those days and Noble Trewitt, you know. So, and Keith Stuckey taught me a lot of stuff, too. He was a good horseman, Keith. Very good horseman. Just passed away a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, he was a tremendous trainer. You know, in those days, those guys, they had long careers on the track, and they knew pretty much everything about a horse. Veterinarians weren't as prominent as they are in today's racing.
No, not at all, yeah. We didn't even have cortisone back in those days. We didn't even have scopes. We never knew a horse bled. You know, the technology in those days was a lot, you know, good horsemen back in those days. Not veterinarian training.
Yeah.
You know, Cliff, that brings up another point that we hear talked about quite often in this sport. People will say, well, the horses today aren't as sound. They're not as strong and stout as the horses back in the day, for example. Do you agree with that or no?
Definitely. Definitely. I think we caused that ourselves. You know, you take a stallion that, you know, well bred, he ran 3-4 times. And you take mares that unraced or, you know, well-bred. Oh, they were sounder. Yes, much sounder. I don't know if it's the racetrack, the breeding, but, you know, it sure has changed today.
Yeah, I know some people will say, well, you breed the best of the best and hope for the best, and that was always kind of the old axiom in racing. It seems like maybe that's even changed a little bit too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, like, you know, you take sires only ran 3-4 times, you know, and they're bred to unraced mares, but they still, you know, if they look good, they still bring a lot of money in the sale. So people still, you know, the top line, I mean, every sale today, just, you know, everything brings a lot of money.
So do you have to train horses differently than you did when you first started?
Well, trainers are trained different. I mean, back when I was young, everybody trained them to go to the moon. You know, 7-8. I mean, we used to work horses every 3 days, 4 days. 5 days was a long time, you know. But then, you know, who changed the training was Bobby Frankel. Bobby started out, and he'd take these, claim these horses and start dogging them the wrong way and move them all up the ladder, you know. Bobby, you got to get Bobby Frankel. He's changed work patterns on horses. He's made, you know, Bobby, you know, is probably the, like the number one trainer who's changed people in the way they train because he was so successful. I think Bobby was one of the best trainers ever. Smart too, you know. He knew every stake race. Bobby was the best trainer around.
Yeah, he definitely had a knack with the horses, and he did a lot of unconventional things at the time, like ponying horses, and as you mentioned, jogging them. And
yeah, nobody ever jogged the wrong way. Nobody, you know, nobody. And then all of a sudden, Bobby comes out here, like in 71 or 72, start, you know, claiming all these horses were overtrained, and man, he moved right into stake horses, you know. Bobby, everybody's kind of followed Bobby, you know. I don't know any other trainer that, you know, other training programs has followed than Bobby Frankel's, you know. I mean, Bobby is the first one, you know, worked them 6 days out. I mean, you know, every 6 days, and then Bobby sometimes worked 7 days. So, you know, everybody just followed Bobby, and it's worked. You know, he was the best. Sad to lose him.
How much time did you spend talking with him and hanging out at the barns with him, Cliff?
He trained at Hollywood Park, and I always preferred that racetrack, keeping the horses sounder. So, you know, I was always over there with Bobby. And, you know, Bobby sometimes, you know, if you get his ego, you couldn't shut Bobby up, you know. So, you know, you just build up his ego, and he was your best friend. He'd talk and talk and talk and talk, you know. But, he was a great guy. Great, great, great trainer.
And then, you know, I think Bob Baffert might be the next guy that came along that kind of changed the face of training with his super fast
works. Nobody works like Bob. Yeah, but I don't know who else works like Bob.
Well, nobody has horses that can work like that, but it kind
exactly.
of kind of forced everybody up the ladder a little bit as far as works, you know. Because the owners would say, well, Baffert's horse just worked in 58 and 2, and our horse worked in 101. So, you know, you kind of had to at least be within a second or two of Baffert.
No, that's very true, too. You know, I mean, Bob, he, you're right. He came around, he changed it the other way. He trained harder than anybody work-wise, you know. And look how successful he's been, you know. Very, very, very successful.
All right, so that's two different training philosophies with Hall of Famer mm-hmm. Bobby Frankel, Hall of Famer Bob Baffert. How would Clifford Sice describe your training philosophy?
Probably more like Bobby. I mean, I don't believe in working a horse fast, you know, unless they're just doing it on their own. You know, I mean, you know, you got, when guys got a lot of horses, you know, you're going to go through a lot of horses. But, you know, when you don't have a lot of horses, you try to keep them sounder, and you may not, you know, want to work as fast because you want to keep that horse around. And, no, I've never been a fast work trainer, but I used to be really good with first-time starters. Now I suck. I don't know what I'm doing wrong.
Well, Richard Mandela told us when we interviewed him a while back that when he was younger, he knew every start counted. He was trying to make a name for himself, so he had the horses a little bit fitter and a little bit more ready to run right away. But as he matured as a trainer, he realized that the horses would last longer if he took it easy on them. So maybe that's where you're at.
Yeah. No, see, like training for Marty Wygod, that's the way he is. You know, he's very. Very good, you know, we start them off slow, and, you know, oh, God, you see Marty Wygod's 2-year-old crop this year, unbelievable. If you don't hear some noise, you know, this coming summer or, you know, from Marty Wyckoff's horses. I did something totally wrong.
If you can't win with those horses, you might as well give it up, right?
Exactly. I mean, well, what a nice crop he's got. Yeah.
What's it like to train for Marty Wyckoff?
Oh, very good. You know, he, you know, especially being here in San Luis Rey, you know, he likes to come out and watch some work. You know, it's him and his wife, Pam, she's a sweetheart. It's fun when he comes out, you know. You know, like, you know how some owners are, you go, ugh. But no, when he comes out, it's fun, especially when the horses are all doing good. You know, get a little smile on Marty's face. It's nice to see, you know.
But he's been in the business a long time, so he knows the ups and downs of it. But he's always had tremendous success.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I mean, he's been really great lately. You know, really, really, really good. You know, but I tell you, this crop, 2-year-olds. You know, I can't tell you who's the best, and I can't tell you nobody's bad. You know. I can't even tell you who the worst one is. But I can't tell you who the best one is. You know, that's how good they all are. You know,
wow.
Amazing bunch of Kentucky bred horses he's got this year.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing those 2-year-olds from the Wyckoff ownership group. And how about in terms of the owners of Dancing Candy with Halo Farms and Jim and Diane Basher? Tell me a little bit about them.
Well, you know, Teddy bred the horse, and, you know, we knew he could run a little bit. So, and, you know, he was good friends with Sid and Jenny Craig, so, you know, he always supported him on Candy Ride. So, you know, he likes Candy Rides. But Teddy had some 2-year-olds, and I think he bought in. One's out at the farm now. And then the other one is Dancing Candy, you know. So he bought into 2 of them, and one, you know, one turned out great. So,
well, that's a good average.
Very nice people too. Oh, very super nice people. The Bashers, very nice.
Yeah, that's Teddy Aroney, right?
Well, yeah, he's the one that brought Basher into the game.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. But all very, very good people. Teddy's very smart, you know. Teddy. He's a horseman too, you know. So Jude knows that.
yeah, he's been around a long time. You mentioned working for Noble Threewit, and he's a trainer I think that doesn't get enough credit on the national stage. I mean, he was a tremendous horseman. What few things did you learn from Noble that you are utilizing to this very day?
Well, one thing, you know, when you took Noble sent me horses up north. You had to continue a little hard training on those horses. You know, you couldn't lighten up on them. His horses always look good. I know he loved you because he used to flatten out his shed row for him when you walked down it every day at Del Mar. If you remember that.
Yeah, I do. He used to tease me about it all the time.
I know. Yeah. He was a great horse. Very good horse. Very good trainer. Very good.
Now, Clifford Seiss Jr. is our special guest on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. We're only halfway through. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back and we'll tell you about his brief hiatus that he took, a little time in Saudi Arabia. We'll talk about that and we'll talk about some of his other stakes winners. It all comes up next, second half of Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Stay with us. In 2015, the Fasig Tipton selected yearling sales outperformed all major North American yearling sales. The July sale held in Lexington, Kentucky is annually a top-ranked yearling sale by percentage of greatest stakes winning graduates and saw 15 sires represented by their highest priced colt or filly in 2015. The prestigious Fasig Tipton Saratoga sale posted an increased average of over $322,000 while boasting a remarkably low RNA rate of just 15% and was tremendously strong in the middle market with a higher percentage of horses sold in the $100,000 to $300,000 $300,000 range, then book one of the Keeneland September sale. The New York bred sale in Saratoga produced 50 yearlings of $100,000 or higher with an increased average of more than $81,000. The Fasig-Tipton selected yearling sales. Superior results. Visit FasigTipton.com.
Bloom Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pinhooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at BloomRacing.com.
It all started with a dream. A dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Ross Amaya, what a finish to the contest.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm, dedicated to the dream.
They're off to New York, the premier state bred program in the United States. When you own a New York bred, your horse can run for more than $44 million in purses restricted to registered New York breds. And the New York program pays awards to breeders, owners, and stallion owners when their New York breds finish first, second, or third at New York tracks. We have the quality.
Day at the spa, all the way.
You have the opportunity. New York breds, get with the program. The best program.
Don't miss your opportunity to attend the next Thoroughbred Owner Conference being held at Santa Anita Park, October 31st through November 3rd, the same week of the 2016 Breeders' Cup Championships. Enjoy a great lineup of speakers and topics, plus be part of the post-position draw for the Breeders' Cup Classic, as well as the Breakfast Marquee and Clocker's Corner. And to cap it all off, your conference registration also includes reserved grandstand seating for both days of the Breeders' Cup. The Thoroughbred Owner Conference, October 31st through November 3rd at Santa Anita. Register now at ownerview.com.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Exaggerator has made a bold move. He's all the way up to take second now, in between horses, coming after Dancing Candy. Just behind them comes More Spirit with five to make up. Then I Will Score and Smoky Image. Dancing Candy turns for home, and he's trying to fend off Exaggerator, who's two lengths behind second. More Spirit is fully extended. Dancing Candy's the real deal. He's in front by two lengths, coming to the 16th pole, and he takes a major step forward this afternoon. Dancing Candy, wire to wire in the San Felipe Stakes, and there's plenty left in the tank. More Spirit closed well for second, Exaggerator third, Uncle Lino was fourth.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Frank Miramati with the call of the Grade 2 San Felipe. That was at Santa Anita on March 12th. Dancing Candy taking the field wire to wire. He would come back and finish fourth in the Santa Anita Derby, but he is on his way to Louisville 10 days from right now. He will be there to contest the 142nd Kentucky Derby. You will hear that race exclusively with us on the Horse Racing Radio Network. All of our Derby Week coverage coming your way in partnership with NBC Sports and with Westwood One. You can see a complete schedule at horseracingradio.net. Mike Penna and Jude Feld back with you in our Lexington studios, continuing to visit with trainer Clifford Seiss Jr. And before we continue, JT, I want to remind people that if they did miss any portion of this show, and that segment in the first half of the program with Clifford talking in depth about Dancing Candy coming up to the Kentucky Derby, they can go back to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check out the podcast. It's available for you to listen to at your leisure. You can listen on your phone, your computer, your tablet, Bluetooth us in your car, whatever it might be. Take us with you wherever you go at horseracingradio.net.
And on iTunes.
And on iTunes as well. How about that? Big time, baby. So is Clifford Seiss. He's big time. He's hoping to hit the big time 10 days from today in Louisville beneath those twin spires. Clifford, we were talking off air. You and Jude really were talking off air, and you were throwing out names like Noble Three Wit and Charlie Whittingham and Bobby Frankel. And people that listen to the program all the time know that Jude trained for about 20 years out in California. And it really was, when you think back on going back 18, 20 years ago, it really was a unique and a special fraternity on the West Coast, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. If you really go back even further, I mean, you go back to the 70s, 60s. I mean, you know, oh, every racetrack had movie stars. They're jam-packed. If you didn't get there early, God, you end up walking a mile to get into the racetrack. I mean, you know, I think, you know, TVG and everything else has changed this game, and it's kind of sad because, you know, you like to see big crowds at the races. You know, we get them on Saturdays and Sundays, you know, a little bit, but not like it used to be. I mean, you know, God, it used to be such a great sport, but it's taken a little fall lately, you know.
We used to have 20,000 people there on a Wednesday.
Oh, it used to average 28,000 on a Wednesday. Back in the old days, yeah. 28,000.
Wow.
You know,
how many of those movies
on a Wednesday?
How many of those movie stars did you get to meet, Cliff?
Oh, quite a few. There, a lot of them were very nice. I tell you, the nicest one I ever met, though, was John Forsythe. You know who he is, right?
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
Okay. Yeah, he was
I've heard of
down
him.
To earth. Yeah, that, or, you know, what he, that Dynasty, and, you know. But he, I used to sit there and watch football games with him every Saturday up in the grandstand, and just nice, nice guy. Mickey Rooney was a everyday type of guy. Vincent Price, he was a horrible gambler. He was everyday. I mean, you know, just, you know. And even before that time, I mayor and, you know, everybody, you know, I remember going to drive-ins when I was a kid. They show the feature race back east or somewhere, you know, intermission. You know, that's how big horse racing was back in those days, you know. I mean, you can go to the drive-in and, you know, the intermission show had a horse race on it.
Wow.
You know? But it's quieted down quite a bit lately.
Wasn't Jack Klugman, wasn't he big into racing out there too?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he had that one good horse, yeah.
Jacqueline Klugman.
Yeah.
Go figure.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I know. Yeah.
He was.
Well, it's funny, you know, you talk about, you know, when you name horses, you know, our three biggest owners out here back in the old days was E.B. Johnson, Vern Winchell, and Shammy. He was in the Bagels. So all three named, you know, the Bagel King, he ended up being a good horse. The Pie King ended up being a good horse. And the Donut King ended up being a good horse.
Right.
So, you know, there's three of your big owners that, you know, got lucky. And, you know, Donut King, the Pie King, and the Bagel King all ended up, you know. It's amazing, you know, you use, you know, the King and, they all end up being good horses. You probably remember all them, huh, Jude?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And Telly's Pop, Telly Savalas had Telly's Pop.
Because he always sucked on a lollipop.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jude, I say we buy a horse and name it Veal Parmesan King. The Veal Parm King.
Veal Parm King.
That would work.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think names are important on a horse. I really do.
Yeah, I think they kind of set the tone. Well, Donut King, he became a big stallion in California. Mm-hmm. A lot of horses by the Donut King. So,
did Kevin Costner ever have a horse named after him or one of his movies?
No, to my knowledge, the only horse he ever owned was the one that I trained, and it was Proud to Be Together, and he. The horse was named when we bought him, and he liked that name because his partner Jim Wilson and him had TIG Productions together, and they're the ones that produced Dances with Wolves, and they got an Academy Award. So he thought that was a good omen for that name, Proud to Be Together, but he didn't actually name the horse.
That worked out great, huh?
Yeah, it worked out good for them.
especially that movie, yeah. I guess Jim Wilson still owns some horses, I guess.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, he's got horses. I think Rafael Becerra trained some for him.
Is that who trains for him now?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I know Tom Knuth is always trying to get him to make a movie for him, but...
Yeah. A lot of people try to get him to make movies.
Jim Wilson, smart man.
Yeah.
He was the 50-1 man.
He was, right? Yeah, 50-1. That was his latest film. Mind That Bird.
Yep. Yeah. Clifford Seif Jr. visiting with us here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on HRRN. Clifford, let's fast forward a little bit. And when you got later in your career, you decided to step away from full-time training for a few years and take a bit of a hiatus. What led to that decision? And tell me about those years.
Marty Weigod wanted me to come down and break all his babies for him down at Jenny Craig's farm, Rancho Paciana. And I figured, oh, man, a paycheck instead of, training. Yeah, that sounds pretty good. So I went down there, and, boy, it was I love that, actually, because that was a great place, great racetrack to train on, great place to turn horses out. The success that we had, for other trainers, doing whatever we did for them, it turned out so good for everybody. And, you're sitting there right there close to Del Mar and beautiful weather. It's just gorgeous. my house overlooked, wing patio overlooked the racetrack. My other patio overlooked big pastures. Gorgeous. Gorgeous. And gorgeous weather, It was great for the horses.
So what brought you back to training full-time?
After that, Jenny decided she wanted to sell the farm, so I didn't know what I was going to do. Actually, I worked in the paddock at Del Mar for one season. And then I got offered a job in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, for Prince Faisal. So I said, I'll go back there and try it. They're paying me quite well. And so I went back in September. They opened like a month and a half later. And we only raced 2 days a week. And so horses were doing good, training good, and then I win the cup the first week. And, all my horses were running good. And then the third week, he says, we got to run. So I said, we got a couple. I had my airline ticket the next day.
Wow.
They want to run. Different than here, Yeah. So
is there only one racetrack in Saudi Arabia?
Yes. Riyadh, yeah, right in Riyadh, yeah. Actually, one time Riyadh, the racetrack was downtown, but downtown, you know how all those countries have built up so much, then they moved it way out, and beautiful facility, beautiful. I mean, racetrack, horses, sound, it's very nice there, and then all the owners, all the prints or whatever they are, they all have their own training barns there. Big, beautiful houses and everything. So it's very convenient. I mean, the only trouble, your highlight in Riyadh is either going to the mall, supermarket, or out to dinner. That's your three highlight things to do there, and horse racing. So, they just wanted to run more horses. And I don't know, he had an airline ticket for me. I got home, I got home night of Halloween, and I didn't even last 2 months there.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Did you go right back to training when you got back?
No, then I go, then I'm going, what am I going to do? San Luis Rey was reopening, because it had been closed for a while. And the Halo Farms, Teddy Aroni, he offered me some horses. But then Saad called me back from Saudi Arabia again and said, we didn't really do you right. We'd like to bring you back. I said, I'm Saad, are you sure? Let me know. Call me and let me know for sure. So I didn't hear from him for a couple of days and said he wanted to bring 8 horses in. So I brought his 8 horses in. Then he called me the next day, and I said, I've already made my decision. I'm staying here. So then Marty Weigod sent me all his 2-year-olds, and they've both been great, great, great owners for me, So stayed here.
Well, that was a probably a wise decision and a welcome one to your family, I'm sure.
It worked out great, you know. So in a way, I'm kind of glad they fired me, and then I also was trying to get the Sawman down here, and they gave it to Kevin, which would have been better because Kevin knows, how to get, he knows all the people around here, so he can get stuff done better than I could have. So I'm blessed. It just turned out very good for me right now.
Yeah, and earlier, Cliff, you mentioned taking time to work with the Why God's babies and to break the babies. What's the key to being successful when you're working with young horses like that?
Just patience. Don't rush. Just patience. And that's one thing Marty always gives his babies, a lot of patience. Yeah, I broke Sheer Belief down there. And another horse that was going to the Kentucky Derby, Here the Ghost. There's a lot of, broke a lot of good two-year-olds down there.
How long does it take you to know if they can really run?
Well, all I can really tell them is, because, we never work them that fast down there. It's just that if they were athletic or not, And that was one thing I always saw in Sure Believe. He was very athletic. He'd do stuff like when he's galloping, if he goes to bucking or trying to kick another horse. I mean, just the way he did things, so athletic, So, but I didn't know he turned out that good, he was a good horse. Too bad he died because that was a good horse,
Yeah, that was quite a loss. He had a lot of talent, that horse.
A lot of talent, yeah. Mm-hmm. A lot of talent.
Cliff Seiss Jr., our special guest on Trainer Talk presented by FaZe at Tipton. Cliff, let's rewind the clock just a little bit here, and we'll go back to 1996 and your very first graded stakes victory. That was in the Vernon O. Underwood with a horse by the name of Paying Dues. Tell me about that day. It had to be really special.
Yeah. Was that before the Breeders' Cup or after the Breeders' Cup? I think it was after the Breeders' Cup.
Yeah, I think it would have been after, right? The Underwood?
In the winter meeting.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, he ran second in the Breeders' Cup up at Woodbine. And then, he came down. I think I ran, that's his next race after the Breeders' Cup. And he won that. Yeah. He was a nice horse. He's a smart horse. Paying Dues, very smart horse, he'd always run hard, that horse. That was a weird story on him, too. The first time I run him, try to founder the next day. All fours. We had all fours he tried to founder in, but we got to him early and got lucky and stopped the foundering. So, and he didn't rotate that much or anything. We were okay.
What was the first Breeders' Cup experience like?
That was kind of cool. I mean, I was up at Woodbine. Janine Sahadi, she ended up winning the race. So, we're real good friends then. So, we always went out, we were up there. And and that horse, God, you talk about a horse, a lot of times on the West Coast here, we hear trainers when they go to the East, go, man, my horse turned around, his legs cooled out, this and that. He went up there and did a complete 360. I mean, I didn't even have to ice him. He was ice cold. He liked that Woodbine track. And, got to go out and graze. Some of these tracks provide you, a lot of good stuff for the horses, where you can go out and graze them. And that's the only thing in California. We don't have much of that in the barn area, But Woodbine was quite a good experience. Yeah, we got lucky that year. Rain missed all week, and then the sun came out, Breeders' Cup Day, and then it snowed on, I think, Monday.
Wow.
Actually, you got sunburned Saturday. I mean, that's how nice a day it was. And I think on the tarmac when we were flying out of there, it was snowing. So.
So you had one good window of opportunity, and that was on Breeders' Cup Day.
Oh, yeah. It's just like God said, okay, I'm going to open up the clouds and Oh, it was a gorgeous day. Yeah, that's when Dave Hoppins won the big one. And it was a good day for California that day.
Yeah, very good day. And, of course, that was in 1996. And then Paying Dues would come back and take the Grade 3 Los Angeles handicap. But then, Cliff, you had to wait 11 years before your next graded stakes winner. And that came, of all places, at Monmouth in the Jersey Shore Breeders' Cup with a horse by the name of Idiot Proof.
Oh, Idiot Proof, yeah. Nice horse. Broke the track record, yeah. Hold the track record at Monmouth. 107-2. He ran 107-2 three times. Idiot Proof.
What brought you to Monmouth?
Second in the Breeders' Cup, too. Huh?
What brought you to Monmouth with him?
Oh, it's funny. Marty, we were going to go out. There was really nothing at Santa Anita. So Marty says, well, you know, we looked, and there was two places, either run at Monmouth or go down to Florida and run. Well, actually, my son was, his baby was due. I had a string of horses at Philadelphia then, and Rob, my son, was training them, and his baby was due. So I said, well, I'm going to go to Monmouth. So the baby was born on the 3rd. And the Breeders' Cup was on the 4th. I mean, not the Breeders' Cup, the Bay Shore, or whatever it was called.
Yeah, Jersey Shore.
On the
Shore.
4th of
yeah.
July. Yeah, so, yeah. He had a little girl on the 3rd, and then we broke the track record on the 4th.
That's a good holiday weekend.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, very nice. Very nice.
Wow. Is your son involved in racing in any way?
Oh, yeah. He's a horseshoer now.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, he made a smart move and became a horseshoer.
Did he ask you about being a trainer?
Oh, no, he was a good trainer. He was my assistant for a long time and very good horseman. No, my son did a great job. Great job, and then when he was back there, he started learning to shoe, and he didn't want to tell me because he thought I'd get mad. And no, I was happy as a lark for him, you know. I said, that's great. You know, so then we ended up closing the string down there and let him come back here. And he, you know, went to school and then he became a horseshoer. He's done a very good job. He's a very good horseshoer.
I assume he works for you.
Yeah, he's very creative. You know, one thing about the, I'm sure there's good horseshoers back east too, but, you know, I think back in California, we got to be a little more creative with our tracks, you know, and shoeing, you know. But I don't know. It might be the same way back east. I don't know.
I think that the hardness of the tracks in California could create some of the foot
right.
problems. So I think
That's
you're
what I'm
right.
saying, right.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we have to bar shoes, this, you know, plates, this, that, glue on shoes, different kind of shoes, you know. So, you know.
Well, I want to go back to Idiot Proof for a minute, Cliff, because you mentioned how fast he was, but not only did he win the Jersey Shore, but he also gave you your lone Grade 1 victory in the ancient title that same year in 2007. Look back on that day for a minute and tell me about winning the ancient title.
Well, sitting up there in the box with Marty and Pam Wygod, I thought it was a tough race. I didn't, you know, not like, you know, but... He ran wire to wire and just held them all off. So, you know, it was fantastic for me, you know. Especially when an ancient title, like I said, I worked under Keith Stuckey a lot, and he trained an ancient title. So it was one of my happier moments in horse racing.
Yeah, that had to be a great thrill because ancient title was such a fantastic horse anyway. And Keith
yeah.
training him and your closeness and all that, it's always
right.
– always really cool if you can pull something like that off. And
yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Was Keith with you that day?
Keith, no. He was up at his home in Bradbury. Yeah. Keith lived for a guy you would think wouldn't live long. You know, he smoked camels all his life, drank, and boy, you know, he just died a couple weeks ago.
He was a good man.
Yeah, he was. Keith, he was funny. Funny. Yeah, one great story. Were you ever at the old Seaside Village where the trailer park was at Del Mar?
Yeah, I used to go visit some people over there once in a while.
Okay, remember, you know, you could drive the circle around there and it had speed bumps on it?
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, Keith could have made millions of dollars. He'd put a shot glass full of whiskey on top of his head. And he says, I'm going to drive all the way around this trailer park and I won't spill a drop. Well, you know, you got the speed bumps and, you know, he might have been about a half crock. You know, he'd bet that, you know, he'd bet for sure he'd spill something. And he was good at that. Drive all the way around that trailer park, speed bumps and all, on a little Stingray, and never drop. Not one drop ever came out of that shot glass.
Wow.
He was always entertaining. You know?
Party tricks.
Yeah, right. Oh, it was amazing. Yeah. I mean, just even keeping that shot glass on top of your head.
Yeah, that. Enough. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Cliff, only a couple of minutes left before we have to wrap up this edition of Trainer Talk. Been a delight to hear your story. I always like to end by asking trainers to tell us a little something about them that people might not know. So when you're not at the races, what other things does Cliff Seiss enjoy doing?
I used to play golf once a week, but I haven't done that in 5 or 6 years. Really, not much. Not much. You know, I mostly like to hang around feed time, and I kind of spend the whole day and then drive home and take a little nap, right, you know, around 4:35. And then my wife's a good cook. She fixes dinner and watch a little TV.
You know, it's funny. I would say tongue in cheek that was a great answer to that question, because you said not much, but that is the answer that every great trainer who has appeared on this program has given us. Richard Mandela, Bill Mott, they've all said, really, not much. Horses are my life. Racing is my life. And I guess you have to be that dedicated.
Yeah. Now, you're kind of married to these two, you know. You know, you have two wives, your wife and horses. Sometimes the horses come first. Well, you know how it is with a family. That's the mistake of having a family and being a trainer. Boy, you sure don't do the right things by your family, you know.
Well, Clifford, we want to wish you all the best 10 days from today in Louisville. We're going to see you over there during the week, and go get it done with Dan's and Candy.
You got it. I appreciate it, guys. Thank you very much. Enjoyed.
All right, Clifford Seiss Jr. here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Like all of our guests who appears on the program, going to receive a gift courtesy of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. We will send those out to Cliff and really appreciate him taking the time. Boy, what a life, huh? I mean, the guy almost gets killed at the age of 12, and then he goes on to do some pretty good things as a trainer. Goes to Saudi Arabia, takes time away to break babies. I mean, just a lot of different things that people probably didn't know about Cliff Seiss.
Yeah, well, he's a multi-talented guy. He's a tremendous horseman. He's been in the business a long time. He's learned from arguably some of the best trainers in California. So, you know, he's an amazing person. You listen to his story and you just go, wow. One twist after another. And a guy that's devoted his life to our sport, and you got to love that.
It's funny, when he was talking about Arcadia, California, which is also your native land, he mentioned that everybody back in the day had horses in their backyard and a chicken coop.
That's right.
Did you have either of those?
I had both, actually. I had a house that I could keep two horses on, and we built a chicken coop as well. And so we had fresh eggs and horses.
We'll have to get you a trainer, Reed Baker, up in Canada. He raises show chickens, by the way.
Show chickens? I didn't even know there was such a thing.
How about that?
I guess you can show anything.
Almost anything.
Yeah.
Our thanks to Clifford Seiss for joining us here on the program. We're back next week with another edition of Trainer Talk. For our producer, Lee Delapina, for Jude Feld, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton.